wish to thank you very, very much for such a very warm welcome. Our attempts to come here has only been delayed because of all the work we have to do and because of the tyranny of time. It's a tyrant time. Osage folk Kwame Nkrumah used to whistle all the time, so many beautiful things to do, so little time.
We're speaking with Darrah Ball, who is first a father and husband, and then a professor of media and Africana studies at Morgan State, and produces multimedia for imixwhatilike.org. Darrah, welcome to Voices with Vision, brother.
Always a pleasure, my man.
So we want to talk to you about your article on imixwhatilike.org. It's called Stokely, a review of our premier interpreter of Black Power Studies. And it's a review of the book by academician Pernell Joseph, and it's his book, Stokely, A Life. And so I wanted to get to tease what you wrote out for our listeners, because as we all know, that soon to be coming up is February Black History Month, and I'm sure the more amenable those who are not so challenging to the political faint of heart will get all this attention. But your article, which really, I think, does a really good job of, I have to admit that I have not read his book. But also for full disclosure, I have to admit that I'm a former member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and actually did organize with, as a young, I mean, not any special close way than many of us who were in the APRP, with Kwame Ture. So I have that perspective. And maybe even a bias, people might say. But I wanted to tease out some of the stuff in your article. And I guess first, if you could begin with a summation of what you view is how we should be looking at the article. What's problematic and what are its virtues?
Well, first of all, with the Pernell Joseph book, I had initially written this review.
Yeah, the book, I'm
sorry. It came out in 2015. And reposted it because, as you pointed out, this is the 50th anniversary of Black Power, a lot of focus and renewed attention on that history. And there is also going to be a character nominally listed as Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture in a forthcoming Spike Lee joint, which all of which makes me nervous. And so just to quickly blend the two articles that you mentioned, the quick point would be that the Cuban understanding, I think the Cuban appropriate understanding of the politics of media and the function media are meant to play, and the function symbolism and narrative are meant to play in organizing people and movements and nations, needs to be understood better, I think, by many of us. In this context is relevant because, as the Cubans were very clear and are very clear, the popular symbolic representation of something can have a great impact on not only what people, of course, first understand of that thing, but then how they act in relationship to or response to that thing. So if the popular, just to come back now, is if the popular image of Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture is one that can be turned into, as Pernell Joseph does in his book, one where there was some value to this man early on in his career when he was doing nonviolent protesting with Dr. King, and when his focus was mostly around electoral politics and organizing. But then he lost his relevance. He lost his sort of political mind and his connection to his community and his people, and remained in a state of political immaturity by moving beyond electoral politics and civil rights into more radical theory and ideology and becoming Kwame Ture. So in short, what Pernell does is he says, I'm going to resuscitate the life and importance of Stokely Carmichael, but does so by rebranding him again as only being of value when his focus was mainstream integrationist electoral politics, but once he moved into Black Power, scientific socialism, Pan-Africanism, armed self-defense, internationalism, etc., he had lost again his political mind and sort of regressed into a political state of immaturity. And just to sort of wrap this answer up, my real point in both of those pieces is that the projection of symbols of history, of race, of economics, etc., is essential in not only situating what people think about the past, but of course impacting what we do now. So if young people, particularly joining the Black Lives Matter or some new version of political protest, get a reference point back to Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture, because he is too big to fail in that sense, he is too big a figure to fully omit, they will go back to a version, or they will find a version popularized by Peniel Joseph and his supporters that doesn't encourage radicalism, that doesn't encourage revolutionary activity, which, as you or anyone who just listens to Stokely for 5 minutes knows, is just impossible. Mm-hmm. So in effect, it's the same thing we were arguing with the Manning Marable book about Malcolm X or anyone else. Yes, I want you to read what I've written, and I want people to hear what I have to say. Of course, I'm, you know, no different than many others in that respect. But you don't have to. If you don't listen to Jared Ball for five, or you read anything I've written, and you just go and listen to Stokely or Kwame Ture, or read his works, you'll see that it's really not complicated in terms of understanding what he wanted. Maybe more complicated in terms of how he broke down his analysis or arrived at his conclusions, but understanding that he was not just about, oh, things are okay today and we're making significant progress, et cetera, that's not that difficult to realize once you just deal with him for a short period of time.
This question of not wanting to be an African is based squarely in ignorance. The enemy keeps us ignorant. Not haphazardly, but by calculated plans. Go and pick up any textbook that you have that you had as a child. Go now and pick up the textbooks that your children have. The only time Africa is mentioned is that she gave slaves to America, and that the slaves who came from Africa to America should be very happy, because the price of slavery and the oppressions of America is better than the barbaric life which we lived in Africa. Thank you very much, America. Here's a fax. You will read in all your textbooks about all the great things the Germans did. The contribution of the French to world humanity. The contribution of the British to world humanity. The contribution of the Italians to world humanity. But Africa, no contributions at all. We say in the very beginning, the struggle here begins with a fight against ignorance. But this fight against ignorance must be properly understood. Not only does the enemy make you ignorant, but then he makes you want to love ignorance and hate knowledge. Hate knowledge. Take any unconscious African. Hey, brother, hey, sister, what's happening in Africa? I ain't no African. Well, I know you don't know nothing about, I know you ain't no African, but would you like to read something about Africa? What's that gonna do for me? And they think that when they respond to this, that they're really thinking. Taught by the enemy to react to stimuli, and in the act of reacting, they seriously think they are thinking.
In terms of black scholarship today, what I would call, I guess, referred to as black scholarship today, and its exigencies are in its use, because I do agree with you that we really need to. I think there's a lot that dissuades people from going to what we call the primary sources and understanding things. And in that sense, though, is there, because some of these things, I mean, Kwame is just one example of many people who actually have their own body of work and whatnot to go to understand them. What then becomes the role? I mean, if people like Peniel Joseph are not, what should be the role of black scholarship today in terms of looking, reflecting on what has been in the past, particularly historians and whatnot?
So this is always a pet peeve of mine, that all of us are often just sort of lumped into this category of academics and often dismissed as being in an ivory tower and so on and so forth. There, just as in any other field or any other profession, there are varieties and variations. So I wouldn't want Peniel Joseph to be a representative of black academics any more than I would want his book to be a representative of Kwame Ture. So I would just encourage people to understand that, just as in any other field. I mean, there are good, quote unquote, good and bad people that work at McDonald's or who work at WPFW or who work at a car sales. You know, there are politically valuable and politically less valuable people in all of these settings. And the same is no different for, you know, the same is the case for academia. The point, I think, always needs to be understood that there is this power struggle going on, and academia is forced into it just like anything else. So in this sense, what I would just simply describe for this quick conversation is more reactionary political forces in academia and the state itself look to promote and encourage certain forms of product and promote certain forms of ideological historical product and omit or look to marginalize others. This is why I point back to that great book by Stoner Saunders, on Francis Stoner Saunders, on the CIA and the cultural industry, where she quotes people from the deep state, as it's now being called, who would say, look, the goal isn't to set up a situation where we overtly pick people to play certain roles for us. The goal is to set up, as they described, a set of criteria that others will aspire to, out of which we can then select people for certain positions. So in other words, they're not going to say, in this case, omit Jared Ball and select Peniel Joseph. What they'll do is they'll set up a criteria that says, here's what we're really looking for. We're looking for emphasis on, in this case, civil rights, electoral politics, integrationism, nonviolence, and anything that would tend to equate with legitimacy or value Kwame Ture's evolving politics, as I might describe them, to incorporate Pan-Africanism, socialism, armed struggle, etc., then once those criteria are met, we will just marginalize or unfund or ignore that work. So what I think that the role of scholars should be is to engage. Look, we have a privileged position. This is sort of supposed to be the trade-off, where theoretically, at least, we're supposed to be trained and given time and resources to study, read, and actually not just read, but to study. That is, to read a book or read articles and engage with peers and senior level intellects or professors who will walk you through and help you not only understand what you're reading, but understand how, ways to assess the value of what you're reading. That is, for instance, reading other books. So, for instance, why in Stokely a Life by Peniel Joseph, who is a very well-paid, very well-promoted, very well-prominently placed scholar, how is it that he could write a book about someone that does not even reference in one instance the man's autobiography? Just methodologically, that should expose what Peniel has done here as fraudulent. That is, even if you want to say Carmichael or Ture's autobiography with Michael Thelwell was somehow flawed, then you need to explain that. You need to acknowledge that. But to omit it and deny its existence altogether is just poor scholarship. But you, as I argue in my article, you have to do that if the goal of your book is to serve a higher political function of denying us access to the man as he really was. And even as I said, you can go off and hear or read Carmichael or Ture in his own words, in his own terms. The value of scholarship should be that in addition to just reading as an individual, that there are groups of people who can, as I said a moment ago, exchange, peer review, check, read back sources, compete with their interpretations over how to understand historical data and so on and so forth. So it just moves beyond one person sitting down to read one book. That's great, but that is different from what scholars and academia is supposed to produce and is supposed to be given room to do. So if that's not happening, but again, all of that happens in a political context. And that's the point, as I started off with, that we have to remember, so that all that research, mine included, occurs in a certain context, and within that power struggle, there are certain, again, just like with everything else, some have to be promoted and some has to be consigned to the margin. And finally, we always have to remember the counterintelligence program, the fifth tenet as it applied to Black America, said very clearly that any effort has to be engaged in to make sure that young Black people don't pick up Black radical politics. Mm-hmm. So consciously or not, overtly or not, I would argue this is part of that same process, the production of intellectual work that walks people away from their own radical traditions.
Yeah, and I have to, one, speak on in that light where you just ended with. I looked up and trying to do a little preparation for this interview. It was an interview of Pernille Joseph on the PBS NewsHour by the late Gwen Ifill. And one of them, I can't remember whether it's her or him, but they, you know, both just kind of concurred, is referring to Kwame Ture as having left the U.S. to organize in Africa. And to me, you know, it was a passing remark, but it was, you know, to me, those can be a lot more damaging when they go unchallenged.
Its author is Pernille Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University. Welcome back to the News Hour, Pernille.
Thank you for having me, Gwen.
Cover of your book has a picture of Stokely with his fist in the air. That's the way people think of him. Is there more?
Black power only tells a part of the story.
It's interesting. Even though he was considered to be the most difficult, the most controversial of the three of them in lots of ways, he lived longer than either of them did, and he was not assassinated like the other two.
Yeah, both King and Malcolm die at 39. Stokely Carmichael, who becomes Kwame Ture, moves to West Africa. He goes to Guinea. And in a way, moving to West Africa, where he's this Pan-Africanist organizer and revolutionary, it dims his star wattage in the United States. Some people say, well, what happened to Stokely Carmichael? Well, he marries Miriam Makeba, the really beautiful South African singer. He moves to West Africa. He continues to organize, but he's not organizing in the United States.
And as a person who was in the APRP the whole time, met Kwame while he was living in Africa, to me, I see him and his value as an organizer. And also what you talked about in terms of the staying away from black radical politics today, if it's an evolutionary process, would include a Pan-African purview, a Pan-African grounding, centering in terms of how we should look at things. So Kwame was not just organizing in Africa when he left. He left and lived in Africa, but was organizing globally. And that's what my experience was with the APRP and the APRP doing that. We were here in this area and across this country organizing speaking engagements with Kwame and all these colleges and universities and other venues around this country and around the world, other places. And then also what people don't know is things like the African Anti-Zionist Front, which was initiated by the APRP and Kwame Ture and some other people. So these are global politics to which I would think it falls into what you just said, the fifth tenet of the COINTELPRO is to dissuade us from advancing our struggle beyond where it was. So I don't know if you had any, that's what I was thinking on that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you're talking about is actually sort of the crux of the point here, that if, first of all, that's what Pernille does in his book. And you have to not only be, I think, somewhat of a well-versed reader of black history or African history and liberation struggles and of Kwame Ture's history specifically to catch it, but you have to pay attention. Like, when you read his book, he's very slick. I mean, and Pernille is a talented writer. He's no dummy. So that makes it even worse for people like me, more challenging for people like me, because what he does is he claims he's praising Ture. And in fact, he says he's going to use the word resuscitate him. And he, quote unquote, praises him for a career of trying to radicalize American democracy, which is a way of rebranding what Ture was doing so that largely affluent white audiences, liberal white audiences who would read this book and make it a New York Times bestseller, won't be offended or scared away by Ture's clear condemnation of this country as being undemocratic and woefully, hopelessly undemocratic, and the prescriptions that he offered in response, that those kinds of readers don't want to read about radical Pan-Africanism, internationalism, scientific socialism, armed struggle, so on and so forth. That is understandably not what they want to read about.
Consequently, the very system has corruption built into it. And if you're poor, they make you rich. And once you become rich, no matter what you say, you forget the poor. I know many comrades who fought with me in SNCC. I see them all the time. They say, oh, you know, I've got to go out here. When they left SNCC, they say, listen, you know, thing is rough. I want to go out here and make a little bit of money, but we need money. As soon as I get the money, I'll help support the revolution. All of them become rich. And every time you see them, they're the first to cry poor mouth. I ain't got no money. Life is so hard. I can't do nothing. So I don't even ask them for money. They're not going to give it. Once you become rich, you forget the poor. Because the reason you want to get rich is to get away from the poor. That's the only reason you want to get rich.
But if Pernille had been doing an honest job, if scholars are going to do an honest job, what they would do in their books is say, this is what Turay said he was trying to do. This is what we see that he did. And this is what I think was of value or not of value. This is my argument. And I debated Peniel on WPFW when I was hosting there some years ago before this book came out, because he had done the same thing to Malcolm X by saying that Barack Obama was the logical conclusion of black power and the politics of Malcolm X. But if you're being honest, you would say, this is what I think they were doing, and this is where I agree or disagree, and why. So if, in fact, as Peniel does, he does a lot in that book of these little sort of undercover, covert, sort of indirect dismissals of Turay as going off to Africa, as if that had nothing to do with the broader struggle, or as if his efforts there had no positive impact on the struggle in the United States, or that he had sort of walked away from his people, who had, as a black American national community, advanced and matured and moved to electoral political politics and black capitalist endeavor as a way, so in other words, instead of just saying that's my preference as Peniel Joseph, electoral politics and black capitalism, and that's what I see as being of value for black people and why I see is Turay's failings in his perspective, instead of just saying that and arguing it, which at least make you honest, he tries to make it seem as though, as I've been saying, Turay just immaturely and ignorantly walked away from his people, that his people were making a more advanced choice. And as I try to point out in that article, he says nothing of the fact of the state's response to these efforts that encourage certain forms of political organization and movement building. So he makes no room to discuss, he doesn't mention the counterintelligence program at all. So he makes no room to discuss the efforts of the state to marginalize people like Turay, to exile people like Assata Shakur, to assassinate people like Malcolm and Martin, and so on and so forth, which forcibly pushes, and then to replace them with acceptable leadership, which is what forces people to move in more, as a collective, into more reactionary or liberal forms of movement and politics. Peniel doesn't address any of that, even to say that that is what should have happened, even if he wanted to admit that that's what should have happened, he doesn't do that. Mm-hmm. So it leaves the reader with this, again, if you're not aware, you can get caught up in it, and it leaves the reader with this assumption that, oh man, this dude had the potential to be really great. As Peniel points out, he actually says, Turay had the potential to be great, but he blew it by going off in this radical direction. And people like me are reading that saying, oh my goodness, no, he had a chance to blow it, but he became great. And it was the response of the state and its academics that have pushed him into the margins to the extent that he has. And then my final point here very quickly that people do have to check out if they read that book is that almost none of what's supposed to be a biography of this man's life covers the last 30 years of his life. There's almost, I think it's like one chapter somewhat dedicated to the last 30 years of this man's life. So it is intentionally designed to make it seem like all of those 30 years of radical organizing, of being popular in so many places, of being clear in what he wanted to leave for his people in the world, all of that and all the positive work he did for political prisoners and everything else, all of that is either ignored entirely or diminished to the point of being seen as irrelevant to an uninformed reader.
Started a campaign in 1972. What was the campaign? Smash the Democratic, Republican, and all capitalist parties. We invited many people to join us. No one joined us. They're all crazy. You know, the Democratic Party is just getting us into positions. We're just getting here, we're just getting there. We understood from the very jump that those positions which they made were to fool the people. But we know you can't fool the people. You can only fool the petty bourgeois elements. It is they who ran to be mayors. The capitalist system thought they had us. With African mayors in the cities, we got them. But Los Angeles showed them. You put anybody there, you won't fool the people. They wrecked Los Angeles even with an African mayor named Tom Bradley, who came up through the ranks of the police. You can't fool the people.
And that's how you become, as he once called himself, the father of black power studies. And that's how you turn that into, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary and appearances on PBS and so on. And then, as I point out, how you even have legendary scholars like Gerald Horn and Robin Kelly calling you the premier interpreter of black power. And just for the record, I challenge both of those brothers directly on their description of Peniel Joseph and encourage them to please revisit their description. And so anyway.
So, and what did they, no word back or?
nothing was said back publicly. The response I got back from Horn were, well, actually, the response I got back from both of them was more or less that they agreed with my critique. Neither of them disagreed with my critique, but that they both, in one way or another, thought it was more valuable to hold off on that critique and support Peniel Joseph, or be seen as supporting Peniel Joseph, because I think mistakenly they fall into that category of believing that any discussion of Kwame Ture is better than none. And I actually feel very different about that with all of these subjects. I would rather they be discussed not at all than discussed in these bastardized forms.
I would have to lean toward that. I mean, yeah, if you're going to do that, then you're really just aiding and abetting the misinformation. And, you know, but I wanted to slip into connection between another article that you wrote, Image Weaponry and the Cuban Example, which, of course, you happen to write two things that I have an affinity for in the subject. And so, if you can summarize, like give a little summary of your article, and then I'll slip in a question with it in the pre-revolutionary society, because what you do in the article is, one, you talk about the, and you can correct me if I get it wrong, is that the importance of media, but also the importance that the Cuba itself, revolutionary Cuba, had an acute awareness of the importance of imagery and media on advancing, but also in it you point out that well, not just within the U.S., but in globally, we don't always, because we don't control it, we also have to be aware. It's not just about what we put out, but what is put out around us and how that works. It also made me think of something Kali Akuno wrote recently about technology and all those kind of things. They're also tied in too many ways that we have much time for. But I guess let me just let you do that, like
as quickly as I can. I mean, the article I wrote was in response to Daruba bin Wahad asking a number of us to respond publicly and to develop as much conversation as we could around this piece from Al Jazeera's The Listening Post on the history called History Through Cuban Eyes, Noticiero, ICAIC, which was about the noticieros, the Cuban newsmakers who, among many other things, used the newsreels before theater film showings, as often was the case, not just in Cuba, but around this country, around the world, to promote and defend the Cuban Revolution. And they were very clear that they basically understood that they needed to use art and culture and, of course, ideology to defend what was happening in Cuba, and not just what was happening in Cuba, but to defend the representation of what was happening in Cuba that was being depicted around the world. That, in other words, they understood very clearly that there was a war of images going on, and the United States and her allies were looking to depict the Cuban Revolution in one way, and they needed to depict it in another. So they recognized intimately in ways that I don't actually think a lot of us fully agree on. And that was sort of my point to Daruba and in this article, that a lot of us really don't agree on this issue of the relationship of pop culture, media, and political struggle. And so I try to point out in that article that for a long time, my own limited work has been centered around this particular issue, and that, again, I've been mostly in conflict with my peers and generational peer group around this particular issue. And just as we just pointed out, the crux of it is I'm in constant disagreement with the more popular belief that if we get a reference to Steve Biko in A Tribe Called Quest, or we get a Spike Lee Malcolm X film, or we get a Nat Turner film from Nate Parker, that the simple references to these individuals will lead people to an investigation and greater study and blah, 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 movement building around all that. And I just don't think that that's what happens. In fact, I think it's pretty clear historically, scientifically, that's not what happens. In fact, quite the opposite. People think that they assume some level of understanding after having seen these movies and don't further study and investigate or become radicalized. And the Cuban people seem to understand that. These newsmakers seem to be more clear about that, that they have to be aggressive. They had to be stylish. They couldn't, you know, they had to be talented, but they had to be aggressive in promoting the ideals of the revolution through their media work, because they understood that it's a battleground, that culture, media are weapons and battlegrounds, and we can't just cede them to our enemies simply because we feel like we're getting some form of symbolic representation given back to us that appeals to us. We can't get caught up in that. So that's basically it. And I try to point out a couple of examples from my own work and experience that address this and point to some of those debates. And I hope that people will pick that up and watch that documentary and pick up these arguments, because I think what Daruba was trying to get us to do is exactly right. Have these kind of debates and discussions that I don't think enough of us are having. And in our media environment today, we really need to be having them, because I think people are wildly confused about what's going on out here.
Oh, yeah, and I'm really in line with you on particularly what you just said. I think some of these movies and even these books, they can instill in people because it's done in such, and I don't know how deliberate it is, but there'll be certain points of, you know, truth that instill in people a cognitive dissonance, so that if they're brought up, and so they give them people one narrative and they think they know, and then when that narrative is challenged, people have an aversion to it. And it's challenged by the truth. And so it's even more than just people thinking that they know. It's also they get a complacency with what they know, or even beyond a complacency. They get invested in what they know, and they become.
Well, it's also very, very quick. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I think just very quickly, now dealing with it for something else. George Gerbner's cultivation theory, where it's not only that prevalent themes in popular media encourage us to accept that as real, but it also gives us this false belief that we're addressing the issue by simply digesting so much information about it. So whether it's Black Lives Matter and police brutality or reading a book about Stokely or something else, it's like the assumption is that because we watched some news about Black people being killed by police, or we watched some news about protesters protesting those police killings, that we are involved in somehow addressing the problem itself. And that's just not obviously how it works. But many of us are susceptible to that mythology simply because of the media environment that we're caught up in. And that's why, again, this Cuban example is just so, so important for us in our situation, our context in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of the Cubans' expression, the battle of ideas. They talk about the battle of ideas. I'm going to just leave it there. And I appreciate your article also, and encourage people to read one of the reference people that you reference in your article, Sister Sophia Umoja, who her article, Noble Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. And that, you know, that would be, I'd like to get into that too with you, but she's not here. And then also we ran out of time. We're speaking with Jared Ball, who is the professor of media and Africana studies at Morgan State University and produces multimedia for imixwhatilike.org. Brother, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All strugglers here, you must give the best example to the youth. The only example we can give to our youth today is an organized community. All of you know what I say is the truth. Once we're organized, who can bring drugs into our community? Once we're organized, who can shoot anybody? Once we're organized, who can carry on antisocial behavior in our community? The only reason this can occur is because we are disorganized and make no steps towards organization, only to putting band-aids on problems. You must be organized. It is only organization that will lead us to liberation. You have this responsibility. Educate your people. Push them to Africa. Educate your people. Let them know that we have a responsibility to educate our people. And only we can educate our people, and it can only be done through constant organization. And make one thing clear to everyone, when you join the fight for your people, you join a fight for eternity. There is no resting place here. Like my father used to tell me, son, when I die, I will have enough time to sleep. While you're awake, work for your people without sleep. Thank you. Ready for the revolution.